We return to Japan this week as we combine the two national pastimes of monsters in your pocket with that of monsters destroying buildings. But will this children's film from a first-time director be up to his artwork in other mediums? Find out along with us this week. This is Kaiju vs. History, Jellyfish Eyes.
Welcome back to Kaiju vs. History. This is your ugly, cute little Pokemon, Patrick, and joining me is Chun-Li as Sailor Moon Miles.
What's up, buddy?
Speaking of jellyfish, my jellyfish eyes were popping out of my skull at a couple parts of this movie.
Yeah, this one is one of the reasons I just love doing this podcast is, you know, to kind of occasionally find movies that, like, I'd never even heard of before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes, yeah, we uncover a lot of movies that I hadn't heard of or I had seen in passing. Your Messages from Space and stuff like that. Do we do that one?
I did that with Drew. It's a alien kind of kaiju, not really daikaiju.
Yeah, what did we do? Voyage from Space? There was something from space. Message from Space?
No.
Something there is what it was a movie that was like not really a kaiju movie.
We did Voyage into Space, but
Voyage into Space is what I'm thinking of.
I think maybe the one you're thinking of is Atragon.
I know I'm thinking of something like Atragon, but like I'm also thinking of something that had a very simple title.
Oh yeah. Voyage into Space was the cut together version of the giant robot and
yes. Yeah. And we did watch that.
We did.
So, I mean, there are movies that like I haven't seen and maybe that I have been wanting to get to, like the Daimajin films that we've covered. There are movies I've been aware of. I just hadn't sat down and watched. And then you have movies like this where I hadn't really heard of this movie prior. I don't think I'd seen anything from it. I am familiar with the director's artwork. Mm-hmm. But this is something that I just had never had any exposure to. And I mean, it's one of the things that I think is extremely fun about doing this specific show. Patrick, did you have any prior knowledge of this film before doing the show?
Before doing research into films that have, you know, kaiju like or kaiju kind of monsters in them? No, don't think so. If I had, it was probably through combing the Criterion Collection, because this, outside of the Godzilla films we've covered on the podcast, is I think the only Criterion film we have on our kaiju list. Is that
I think so, but
even in Criterion?
No, I don't think so. I think Legendary Warner Brothers has that one pretty locked up. Although, I mean, they license them out. There's those movies.
And King Kong versus Godzilla is, but not King Kong. So, yeah, this was probably one that I heard of, and I don't know if I ever watched the trailer for, but 2013 film by Japanese artist Takashi Murakami, and this was his first film debut. He was a paint and graphic and sculpture artist primarily, did a lot of graphic work in Japan, in the US, and I think people most commonly know him from, he did the cover of Kanye West's album Graduation.
Mm-hmm. I think he did another record. He did the Kids See Ghosts too, didn't he?
Yes. So he's done some, you know, pretty, I would say, popular kind of contemporary art in that form. I would say he's exhibited a lot in the US, but he is definitely very well known in, around the world, but in Japan especially. And this film kind of came out, you know, when he's already very much at the top of his game in those mediums, in those visual mediums, and really challenged himself, I would say, with going to the medium of film for this film, Jellyfish Eyes, which came out April of 2013, already 11 years old. But this is the first film I feel like we've really dived into that felt pretty contemporary. You know, it has some aging to some of the CGI and stuff, but watching it, I was just like, oh wow, this could have been, you know, very recent. It feels like this movie.
Yes. I mean, we're also entering, the contemporary age. I mean, this movie came out in 2013, and it feels like a movie that came out in 2013. Outside of, you know, some of our American and Godzilla films, we haven't, I feel like, watched a lot of stuff that feels contemporary. I agree with you. Like, even watching the Raiga stuff, like, doesn't feel contemporary in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying this one kind of does. But it also feels like a throwback to the last of the Gamera movies as well.
There is a that vibe. Because so many anime and manga stories do have this idea of, you know, kids moving into more rural areas and they're coming of age of trying to acclimate to that. Since it's such a popular pastiche in Japan, I feel like it's something that's probably not super crazy. And this one doesn't feel rural in the sense of, like, you know, they're out there in the sticks. I mean, these kids have cellular devices, and it's very much a modern movie. It's just in a less metropolitan area than, like, say, you know, Tokyo.
I don't know if they ever name the town that he's in.
I don't actually remember if they do either.
I think they name the kind of power center, but I don't know if that's the name of the town that they're in. But
yeah, if they do, I definitely missed it. But speaking of names,
TDF for that one.
What is in the title?
Great question. So the Japanese original title is Mimimi no Kuragi, which translates to jellyfish eyes, but I think literally to I jellyfish, or I jellyfish. It's like, I think meme is I in Japanese. So meme would be like I. That is the title. That's what you'll find it as around the world. Not really many other translations for it. This movie did, believe it or not, release and debut, I think, in LA first, had its premiere in Los Angeles, and then went around the world, but mostly back to Japan. And it's one of those movies that is such a striking title. You really don't know what it's going to be. And I think I'd preview this just to check. I was like, you know, is this going to be one of those things where the kaiju, the daikaiju in the movie is just in it for like a second, you know?
Which, no, I mean,
it's the last act. It's like the last 15 minutes of the movie.
I will still call this movie kaiju like adjacent.
It's definitely more of a Pokemon movie than it is
absolutely a Pokemon movie,
a kaiju movie.
And but it, I mean, honestly, kind of in the best way possible. This movie is about a boy who he and his mom have been staying at some sort of evacuation center. I know this was informed by the earthquakes from 2011, I think, but
yeah,
they don't specify what disaster these kids or this particular kid is being rehomed from.
Yeah, it's implied that it's, you know, the Fukushima kind of area, perhaps, because they make some of his bullies later in the film talk about him being radioactive.
Right. So. I mean, that is like I said, it definitely heavily informs. They just never specify. But at the same time, in 2013 in Japan, that is 100% what people are going to be thinking about. So,
yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely the artist's intention, as Murakami talked about how, like, what in some interviews and things, what Japan needed to kind of feel whole again. And I think he made this movie, and like a lot of his artwork, to be very bubbly, very vibrant, and, you know, feel good in a lot of ways. And we'll talk about it when we get to the ratings, but the critics and audiences alike did not get this movie. I definitely
critics and audience alikes fools, the lot of them.
Well, I definitely went into this thinking it's like, okay, this is a children's film. You know, you get into it and it's as cartoony and kind of childlike as they come. But yeah, that I think that was his point of view, is he was trying to make something that was heartwarming and can kind of take people's mind off of it. So his main character, the main child actor in the film, Masashi, yes, played by Go, he is, you know, he lost his father in the earthquakes and is extremely glum at the beginning of the film. And over the course of it, kind of meets new friends, both FRIEND and actual, you know, Japanese children. And yeah, begins that healing process. So I really do think this is his way of kind of giving back. And, you know, we'll talk about those kids, but there's some great, great, adorable children in this film. They all, we'll talk about it too, but they all kind of look like the monsters that they have.
Oh, and that's what I love. With the exception of Saki.
So cartoony. Yeah, well, she's kind of like the exception that proves the rule is
her Luxor.
She's like super tiny, and she's got like the biggest of the friends. So yeah, it takes place in this rural area with Masashi and his mom kind of getting away from a pretty hard previous couple years. And as soon as he gets into town, he is met by this little flying sprite. I would say it's probably closer to a yokai than a Pokemon. It's more like a spirit creature. And we find out
this particular one. Yeah. I mean, I certainly think that Murakami is kind of drawing more from yokai in design, but I think he's doing it through the lens of, you know, the pocket monsters for Pokemon.
Yeah.
I think he was smart to do that because, like, yeah, seem like, oh yeah, this is a Pokemon movie, and this is absolutely a Pokemon movie.
Well, you know, what's funny is just about the same time that this movie came out, a manga series and video game came out for Yokai Watch. Have you ever seen that series? And those are definitely, they feel like very same vein.
As
these creatures, they're even like more weird and eclectic than Pokemon, I feel.
But like it makes a difference, because when you have a visual artist like Murakami and he dips his toes into something as, you know, globally, not even recognized, just understood as Pokemon. Like so many generations of people understand this, even if they don't play video games, they understand what Pokemon to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so much so that, you know, there's a Pikachu float during the, you know, the Macy's Day Parade. I think the choice to kind of lean more into like a yokai, it just something that doesn't feel like a brand type, like all these creatures feel designed in from a different perspective than Pokemon it does. And I honestly, it really helped me with this movie because I knew nothing going in. I went in complete, I didn't even watch the trailer. I went in so blind. And this movie was quite the experience as a result. But the Pokemon aspect of it, I think, to me, worked so well because, you know, he created a mythology within his own world building. And these creatures, they felt like they came from this world. They didn't feel like they were, you know, copied and pasted. Because Pokemon does have so many imitators. And to take that Pokemon or a Pokemon-like concept to live action, no less, and do something just kind of completely different. Like, to me, it felt like he was looking at Pokemon through the lens of Hayao Miyazaki.
Yes, there's definitely a lot of Miyazaki DNA in this film. Maybe he's held back a little bit by, you know, not having done the 3D, you know, moving picture medium before, and some critics really kind of harped on a lot of the static compositions and things like that. But at worst, it made it feel in parts kind of like a TV show more than a dynamic film. But there are parts that I definitely enjoyed and felt more like anime than a television show.
There was definitely anime logic to some of this, but it, to me, it kind of, yes, it did feel like, you know, a first time filmmaker using things that, you know, a first time filmmaker would probably not want to do. But I honestly, because of the way that the story was told, and because honestly, because a lot of the, I feel like the character work he did with the setting itself through his direction, it gave, like, even with some of these kind of like uncanny valley moments, like, you know, where the, what does he call jellyfish eyes? Kagane Bo?
Yes, it literally translates to just like jellyfish boy is the main character's. I keep wanting to say Pokemon, but friend. And I had to look it up because it wasn't in my notes anywhere. The friend stands for, gosh, I just had it.
That's life form resonance, inner energy, negative yes. Emotion, disaster preventions. And it only takes the friend part from most of those words.
life form resonance, inner energy, negative emotion, disaster prevention. Ooh, it's so good.
But I love the anachronism, and I guarantee you they made that anachronism.
It's like Calvin Ball rules for making an acronym.
Yeah, an acronym, sorry. But I 100% believe that they had the acronym first and then made something up to go with it.
It's like Calvin's gross. Girls yes. are really gross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, but there is... I like that he kind of does this kind of Studio Ghibli approach to it. Like it doesn't feel like it's done. Like, because of the story he's telling and some of the fantasy logic he's using to tell it. Cause I mean, the like lab and stuff, everything there feels very Kingdom Hearts, you know?
Yeah.
In its execution and in its logic.
The bad guys, the black cape wearing bad guys are pretty cool. Organization 13,
100%. Anime. But the avenue he's going about it is to reflect on, you know, the generation and the culture of the time and trying to find something to say, utilizing these creatures and utilizing this Pokemon like idea. And I think that is one of the strongest parts of this movie. I think that, you know, this whole lens is taking a look at a lot of kids who uniformly are going through rough stuff in all of their lives. And the way that this movie takes a peek at that and how that translates to creating this Pokemon world is, to me, really, really fascinating and honestly really effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoyed them. I enjoyed the friends a good deal. There is
I really went all in on that lizard.
Yeah. There is a world of ugly cute that sells a whole lot in Japan that this really kind of taps into, and I feel like almost
we have ugly dolls here that they sell like hotcakes.
Well, yeah, it's something that has, you know, been kind of pervasive across the world, is this idea. And I mean, it, in every culture they have toys that are kind of, and I feel like they work for both boys and girls because of that. They straddle that middle line. And it is definitely one of those things, you watch this classroom, the first scene in the classroom where all the kids pull out their friends and are playing and fighting and having a good time with them. It's
so
great.
One of the things I loved is, like, again, I didn't know what I was getting into. So when I saw all these other creatures pop up, I was like, wait, is he imagining this? Like, is this like in the theater of the mind? Or, oh no, I did not understand what movie I was getting into. And I was, I mean, I was that scene. I think I've used this on this specific show. I might have done it with Drew. There is a to me iconic scene in The Walking Dead when Carol first meets the king and she goes, "I don't know what the hell is going on in the most wonderful way." And that was my experience for the first half of this movie. Is like, I had no idea where this movie was taking me, but I was all in. And I think part of that is these kids are great actors.
There's some very fun kids in the group as well. My favorite is definitely the the
that kid, one kid
with the hamburger.
I know who you're talking about.
The hamburger keychain.
Yes,
on his
friend.
Yes,
I know exactly
device.
Who you're talking about.
His friend is like a little, it's just like a little monkey, a little tailless monkey, it seems like. And
he's the one that finds out that like his, that his, the main kid's uncle works at the lab.
Yes, and is
and
first one of,
has the weirdest look every single time you see him.
He's got some great faces, and when they cut back to him and they're calling him to get all the kids and use their friends to beat the kaiju at the end, he's making like a face at the teacher where he's like flipping his eyes up, and he's it's yeah. just so good. He is the most cartoonish of all the children, and some of them, their haircuts are styled to kind of like match their monsters, their friends.
Yeah, but the, as a result, you see some dire haircuts in this movie.
Yeah, there's like a kid with an octopus Pokemon, and his hair is like styled like into big tentacles.
Yeah,
the main kid who has a friend with like a giant metal kind of blockhead. I think he's the one that has like a Karen haircut. He's just like, got a big mop of hair on his head. I thought a lot of those design decisions, hair and makeup kind of decisions they had for the kids were awesome. They felt as colorful as the CGI monsters.
Yeah, and that it's a great choice. I mean, especially when you're dealing with just not just a couple of kids, but like a whole, you know, group of kids. And not only are all these kids good, even if they're like being kind of stereotypically written at points, like, you know, we've had a lot of bad kid actors on this show. And the fact that all these kids are at least pretty good at the very worst to legitimately solid. I thought the actress who played Saki was phenomenal.
Yeah. When she's squirting tears out at the end of the movie and trying to console Masashi, saying that his friend will always be with him, I was like, oh man, it's getting misty in here.
It was phenomenal. And I mean, the one
just because, you know, she's actually kind of like also talking about his dad at the same time. It's like, mm-hmm. Oof, that's rough. That is rough what they're doing in this very happy kids movie. And
well, and that's the thing is, like, I don't think it's a happy kids movie. I think it's a happiness. I think happiness as defiance, because like all these kids are from, you know, rough backgrounds. And I don't mean rough as in the, like, they're all poor and about like Saki's parents are in this cult, this like fundamentalist cult. And I mean, you see the wear it has on her and on how that informs her psychology and how she thinks about her friend. Like she treats her friend like a friend, like a Tamagotchi. Like she does not fight, and she just takes him out on walks and plays with him. And
the cult in the movie is definitely not like shown in a super positive light. And I think in an interview he's talked about how people really like fall back on religion when there's like a major disaster like this. The main one that I can, you know, think of in Japan was called Omu Shinrikyo, which was a cult in the 80s and 90s that
the sarin gas
had a sarin gas attack in the Tokyo subway is kind of what they became infamous for. But it's interesting. I feel like we've had I've watched a few movies recently that have had kind of these religious cults depicted in Japanese films. And this one, you know, really from the child's perspective is hard to watch because her mom is obviously going through some stuff as well. But
I think that's what's so great about this movie is like it doesn't give any excuses, because you even see some of the bullies and what their situation is. But yeah, and the underlying thing is that the lab, the black hood people are feeding off the negative emotions of these children through their friend devices.
After the pool scene where they beat up Masashi and all the kids get in trouble and they're getting like yelled at
that scene is
by
rough.
Their parents, I was like, oh no. Then you like instantly start feeling for all these bullies, and it's like, oh, okay, I kind of see what they're doing here. It's this like generational kind of thing.
It's exceptionally well done, because it's a hard, like, I mean, it's a razor wire you gotta walk to make this work. And And the fact that they're able to do it without making the movie overall feel extremely depressing, because on paper, a lot of the things that make this movie work, you're like, oh man, I bet this movie is like super dour and, you know, hard to watch. And it's not. It's a lot of times a very whimsical, dreamlike, like phenomenal film about, you know, found family and finding your place and establishing your place, or dealing with trauma. There's a lot of things that this movie does so well that, you know, on paper, you're like, oh, this has got to be a heavy movie to watch. And conceptually, yes. But the way that Murakami is able to kind of walk through the raindrops on that one, if you will, like just and make this movie as whimsical as it can be sometimes, or at least just feeling like my note was that it felt like 80s Miyazaki. It felt like it from the same crop of like Nausicaä and Castle in the Sky and My Neighbor Totoro. And it felt like in that vein of storytelling where you have these really heavy ideas in this whimsical, fantastical world.
A lot of critics here in the US, I think, likened it to Spielberg's E.T. And that also has kind of a child having to lose a alien, you know, like friend towards the end, and some great tear jerking scenes in that movie. I can see it, but I really do think this movie, as I suppose as cliche in some of its elements as it is also, like you said, kind of making its own mythology, making its own world. There, unfortunately, was not a sequel. I think they were thinking about moving on to doing it again, but
he filmed, like, from what I've heard, like 65% or something. Like, he shot a lot of it at the time he shot this movie.
Makes sense.
I don't know if you saw the post-credit sequence.
You know what? I turned it off. No.
There's a whole thing that's basically like what happens. Like it's like almost like a trailer for, it actually says Jelly Eyes 2 at the end. And it's got some of the same kids and it has different stuff happening. And as recently as like 2020, like he said, like, you know, he released a thing about why I had to abandon it, because he's been working on it for like a decade, but has said that like he's hoping to get back to it. It's temporarily, I think, considered canceled, but he very much has wanted to continue the story of Jelly Eyes. There, I think on YouTube, and there's a series of videos, how I was forced to abandon the production of Jelly Eyes Part 2, which came out in 2020. But I know that he has said that he's hopeful that he might be able to complete it at some point in the future. Because I know that COVID bankrupted the company that was that put it out.
So the trailer that they do have on the Criterion copy, and didn't really even talk about that. Like, who chose this for Criterion? It seems such a out there choice. And I really feel like it's because his connection to the other art world where he's,
I mean, there's definitely that. I mean, look, famous. I mean, the Beastie Boys have a Criterion release. Like, yeah, you know, sometimes some people just get their favorites in. I'm always happy to see more Japanese films, especially from Criterion, because sometimes they'll do, you know, obviously the Kurosawas are out there and stuff like that. But like seeing other films, especially other films that aren't connected with IP, really makes me happy. And a film like this, like just seemingly randomly having a Criterion release is pretty incredible to me.
The trailer for Jellyfish Eyes 2 on the Criterion DVD has a lot more kaiju action. It has I think basically probably what they would have done was some of the creatures kind of get super charged, because there's a sequence in the trailer of like several giant sized monsters fighting, very reminiscent of kind of 1960s Japanese kaiju films. There's a knife headed looking monster and something that looks more akin to, you know, the Smog Monster of Hedorah style.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely something I would like to see, because the last 10 minutes of this movie where every 150 Kanto friend Pokemon comes together with their child's help to fight a large Pokemon, which, what did they call him in this movie?
What did they call him?
Oval?
Yes, I think that sounds. Yeah.
At first, I thought Oval was like the name of the organization, but no, that's this giant creature that is kind of representative of destructive forces in Japan. It might be the cause of the shifting tectonics and earthquakes and stuff. So it's very representative of destruction. And as soon as it comes forth, it, you know, starts smashing buildings and threatening to kill people's parents. And
yeah, because I think one of the business side of the shadow conspiracy group is that, like, one thing they're looking into is like, oh, no, we found a way where you can control the forces that create earthquakes.
Yes.
And I was like, that science doesn't check out, but all right, I'll.
Well, it requires you make children very sad is how you control earthquakes, apparently.
Boy.
We didn't even get to maybe the best part of the film, which, like, halfway or like in the third act, they introduce another kid, a hacker kid who has spliced like his Game Boy on top of his friend device and downloaded and made new friends, including one that his name is Ko, and it's just Ko or Ko 2 is basically a fighting game character brought to life in this form. And we see that that the organization can also make kind of facsimiles of people, because they make one of the uncle as well. But she looks like a CGI character. Like they're purposely making her look.
Are you talking about the like Sailor Moon?
Yes. Chun-Li is Sailor Moon is how I described
it. Or like Sakura. really, she looks more like Sakura from Street Fighter. But like, so that, I'll say this. It was the first thing that really took me out of this movie. Was seeing a humanoid figure friend in battle with the other creatures. I was like, I don't know how I feel. I remember when I first saw that, I was like, huh. my note was like, why is a random waifu here? You know, like, well, I was like, this is such an odd choice. I didn't dislike it, but it did take me out for a moment.
Yeah, you have to take your mind out of the gutter, because these are prepubescent children who...
but like just the choice to have that design. Oh,
the director's choice. Yes. So you see on his device, he actually has access to like 6 or 7 friends, you know, maybe that he hacked into the system from other video games. I wanted so bad for him to switch out and then like all of a sudden there's Sonic the Hedgehog or Mega Man or something like that.
I would not have minded that. It's the one part of the movie that I feel like, I mean, this movie's like lore is like, you're not given a lot of it. What you are given is, and the Kingdom Hearts reference is pretty apt, because like, it's kind of, you just have to take them at face value. Like, okay, that's what it is. I'm not going to question anymore, because then it all falls apart, which is kind of, to me, how Organization 13 works. I have friends who claim it all makes sense and I just do not believe them, but it's the one part that kind of took me out is some of the wackiness in the third act. I like it. I wish there had been a little more meat on that bone. It's
pretty wackadoo.
I do like stuff like the fact that we haven't mentioned that Musashi is basically like Ash, where his friend, he doesn't have a Pokeball or a friend device to basically control him.
Yeah, like, summon him or de-summon him. And those were given to the kids by this black-coated organization so they can harvest their negative emotions.
Negative energy, yeah.
And yeah, his friend, Kuragi Bo, just kind of shows up and is there, and maybe because of some of his dreams was sent to him by his father or sent to him.
Yeah. Because and you also get the implication that maybe his uncle created that one.
I forget. Yeah. But
they don't say anything. They're just implications, because his is different, because like even when they ask about a device, I was just like, well, what are you talking about?
See, so he doesn't get the device until later on, and they find out he's giving like off the most negative energy because his dad died and he's really sad.
The kid's going through some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, we need to harvest this kid's bummer's attitude.
Well, no. They do mention that aspect, but also apparently like he is like the perfect subject. There's something about his connection with his friend makes him the perfect candidate. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, a lot of like kind of video game story points in that. And I kind of love that it does have that, because you know, an American studio would have like done everything they could to make it sound more realistic and more grounded and give real explanations. And here it's like, no, here you go. You know, and I love that choice. Even if I don't love some of the design stuff that was associated with it, I do like that. I love his hero's journey. I love that they don't make the mistake of, you know, Musashi's not just a stalwart and true character. He falls apart like a normal kid might. And I really appreciate that. Like you get it gives this movie a real sense of depth in what could have easily just been a shallow cash-in kids film. But because you have this visionary artist who had something to say, you get this really, really, honestly, just surprising film. Like
definitely a surprise.
Yeah, everything is a surprise. But I think that the way this movie, you know, functions is a surprise. And it's honestly better not knowing anything about it, because watching this movie unfold is pretty magical in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Not having any sort of forewarning. Did you have a favorite scene in the movie, or a favorite friend?
Well, like I said, I really dug the kid with the monkey friend so much. But I think that first scene in the classroom, whenever the teacher turned around and all the kids hid there.
It's so good. Friends, it's such a great sequence.
It's so fun because it really turns it on its ear, because Musashi sneaks his friend in his backpack to school. So you think it's going to be a very cliche scene of like, one other kid sees them, he's got to hide it and pretend like it's a dog or something. You know, he's keeping it from all the kids and they all think he's weird, but they really pull like a 180 on him by showing that they all have them first, really, you know, and yeah. He's the weird one for not having one. It's so funny that what do they think his reaction was going to be? It's like this new kid from out of town. It's like, oh yeah, by the way, here's 20 monsters in
the classroom. Right. No, I mean I agree with you. That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie too, just because, yeah, the unveiling of everything, and then like just the shock of the audience of like, oh, so you aren't in on it. Mm-hmm. You are just as lost as Musashi is. And I really love that. I do love Musashi and Saki's like kind of getting to know you play date thing, where they're kind of explaining themselves to one another. And there's this really great, like seemingly platonic, like handholding sequence where it doesn't feel romantic.
No, it's just what they do in Japan.
It feels like a real bonding moment that doesn't have any sort of undertones at all. And the delicacy and the authenticity they give that relationship between those two characters, I thought was extremely stunning. Obviously all of the fights in the third act are super fun. Like watching Kaganebo like take out.
Well, I also love that their first friend sequence, it shows Musashi showing him like little martial art moves and like training him up. It's just like, you know, a very small part, but then he comes back and the next day he's beating up other friends. And that was a lot of fun. This, I had to look it up, but the chikama that he eats and feeds.
That's a string cheese.
It is not. It is a fish, processed fish product.
Really?
Cheese in it. And I think maybe made from jellyfish as well. But I was looking at it, I was like, okay, it's fish and cheese. You have to refrigerate that, right? They just have them in boxes in their living room. I was like, doesn't this need to be refrigerated?
Does it?
I don't know. But
okay. I thought you found an answer.
I go to Japan, I'm going to try it for sure. But yeah, his father owned or worked in the factory that made them, which is why they have boxes and boxes of them. They're not just really big fans, which I thought was a fun little point. This movie is wild, Miles. Obviously, the Takashi Murakami as an artist, you can buy jellyfish eye prints. They're only going to run you like $2,000 to $6,000, Miles.
Oh,
but there's a 3D plaster figure for sale on Artsy of Luxor holding a Karage bow, which is $2,200. that's it.
Jeez.
Just like, I mean,
this is the kind of movie that is going to have, like, yeah, certainly niche fans. And unfortunately, when artwork and stuff gets made of that, it tends to be very limited and very expensive.
I would absolutely empty a capsule machine of these little guys because they are very cute and they're very, mm-hmm. very fun to look at. There's one that didn't get any kind of focus, but it was like a bell, or there's a bunch that are kind of like inanimate objects. Like there's, you know, Pokeball, like Pokemon, like metal Pokemon. But it was like a bell or like an arch made out of stone that was just in the classroom. It was never like one of the bullies creatures. There's a bunch of them that I really enjoyed. The song for the movie Last Night, Good Night was sung in part by Hatsune Miku.
And yeah. Which makes me wonder, you know, how that humanoid friend got to be there. Cause it felt very Miku like.
Not only that, there's a remix by Pharrell Williams in 2013. Miles.
I enjoyed the Miku song. I mean, I like Hatsune Miku.
Well, I was going to say that that's in the end credits, I think, but
isn't that song playing throughout the movie though?
Well, I enjoy the soundtrack throughout the film because there's a lot of what
to the me score sounds, is fantastic. The piano work is excellent.
In parts, it sounds like PS2 kind of music. You know, definitely. Mm-hmm. 100% Japanese.
Which is like, I mean, catnip for me, so.
Yeah, I actually listen to kind of chill wave stuff that is PS2 video game music. Oh, it's just, it's awesome. I like the soundtrack, but it's indicative of, I think, why this movie did not do super well in the US. This movie was made, I think, really for Japanese audiences in mind, especially Japanese kids. And I feel like, hopefully, they love this movie. Yeah, I feel like it was made just for them. As far as ratings go in the US, oh boy, it's rough. 29% on Rotten Tomato from critics, and a 42% from audience score, which I thought was absolute pretty low monsters. As well.
All of them, absolute monsters.
And yeah, we didn't even talk too much about the kaiju at the end, Opal.
Oval.
Very gross looking multi-eyed monster. I loved the design, Miles. It reminded me a lot of the Ultraman monster that was like thought up by the kids. I don't know if you remember that episode, mm-hmm. but it's kind of got an ugly look to it and doesn't look like it is something that can actually exist, like an animal. It just looks like a big, like, slumped over slug.
Yeah, I'm looking at a gif of it now, and it kind of looks like, do you remember the old Tim Burton kind of sketch drawing stuff for Stain Boy?
You know, I could see
it looks like one of the monsters from like kind of that period of like just random Tim Burton art. Like, it has that vibe. Like, if I found out this was a sketch version of the little Beetlejuice worms, I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird to look at. And I really do think that this movie, you know, put this giant monster in there as kind of a love letter to kids' kaiju movies. So it really does have, and while it's, you know, a relatively small part of the film, it is like the main antagonist at the end of the film that they're trying to, mm-hmm. to overcome. Yeah. And it also becomes kind of a set piece because Saki gets like carted off, like hanging out of its mouth towards the end. It brings up some architecture, yep. and Musashi has to like fly on Karage bow up to save her. It's a very fun sequence, but it is one that I am very happy that we got this on the list, even though it's kaiju like. Do you want to get to rating this bad boy, Miles?
Yeah. Well, what are you thinking, bud?
For personal enjoyment, I'm at an 8. It's one that I am still a little surprised is on the Criterion list when there's so many other kaiju movies that are not. But I was really happy to find this. I think it is probably the best Pokemon movie, like that's not Pokemon, and I'm really surprised it didn't do more gangbusters when it came out. I was looking at the reviews, and a lot of people said that it was boring in parts and kind of drawn out. I was like, I don't remember any part that was, you know, it felt like a very fast film to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. For a movie that, you know, it's 101 minutes, I felt like it clipped along pretty nicely. It certainly felt shorter than some of the 70 minute movies I've seen off of this show.
Yeah, that's the thing.
So apparently on February 10th, 2022, Murakami announced that he was restarting production of Jellyfish Eyes Part 2.
I would love to see it. Like I said, if it's a kind of an evolution of the story, I'm totally on board. I mean, those four cloaked figures like moved off at the end of the movie, and I can see them trying this again somewhere else, mm-hmm. perhaps. But so I'm at an 8 out of 10 for personal enjoyment. I really enjoyed it. I think I can watch this movie again. What about you, Miles?
Frankly, I'm a little surprised.
Is that too high? Is that too low? What do you mean?
It's too low, son.
Oh, okay. Well,
for personal enjoyment, I give this movie a 10. I think this movie is kind of, it's a flawed one, but I think this movie's kind of a masterpiece. I agree with you. I think it's the best Pokemon movie never made. I think that this works so well in everything that it's trying to do. And I mean, this movie's pretty ambitious. And I mean, knowing his artwork but still knowing this is a first time filmmaker, that he pulls this movie off, or the entire crew pulled this movie off the way that they did, is insane. I mean, the score is excellent. The kids are fantastic. The story is incredible and nuanced. And yes, it has some really flawed logic and some paper thin things done in there. But in terms of just actually enjoying this movie, I could not have been happier. So much so, we've talked about it. I bought the Criterion Blu-ray because I loved this movie so much. I think this movie is incredible. I can't wait to watch the features. I'm waving the disc in front of Patrick right now.
It's a great cover.
I'm not sure when this episode comes out, but I happened to watch this during Criterion's half off sale. So I got this for $17, brand new. I think normally it's about 24. It's not a super expensive or difficult disc to find. Criterion typically does an excellent job with the special features. And this one did have the director approved sticker on it. So he had some hands-on work with the making of this release. Yeah, I mean, I this is one of my favorite things I've seen this year. It's one of the things that makes me so happy about doing this show, is discovering these hidden gems and these diamonds in the rough, because I think this movie is absolutely incredible. I will be showing this to many, many people.
Cool. Yeah. It's definitely one that, like I said, if I had stumbled upon this when I was a kid, I would have really, really enjoyed it. Loving Pokemon as a teen as I did as well. I think this would have been right up the alley. And Digimon, you know, we're forgetting there's a digital aspect to the friends as well.
Yeah.
Reminded me a lot of Digimon too. And those creatures are also kind of fugly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What about
Digimon's more MMO stuff though, right?
Yeah, yeah. What about the technical aspect?
So for the technical aspect, I did have to knock it a little bit, because, you know, if I call this a flawed masterpiece, you know, I do think the script probably needed just another pass to kind of smooth out some things in terms of some of the plot, connecting plot points. The stuff with the uncle after the suicide of the uncle, that stuff got really muddied. And it worked as so long as you were following it in the moment. But as soon as you thought about it, you're like, wait, what's going on?
Yeah, I didn't realize
they had a body double.
Well, yeah, and they did it for, I don't know who, because like, I'm guessing someone found the body and
the body was in a public place. Remember, he jumps off the top of the building,
but it never gets back to Musashi or his sister that he killed himself. At least it doesn't happen like.
Yeah, no. When he's in the hospital after being beaten up, she says that your uncle.
OK, well, there you go. In the movie's time, it's a very short amount of time between that and when he sees the double of his uncle fighting his uncle. So it's like,
yeah, it's,
I understand what you mean by muddled a little bit.
There's some muddied lore here that does get in the movie's way a little bit. I do agree with you that, you know, some of the shots weren't probably rendered as well as, you know, a professional, you know, CGI artist might have done. Mm-hmm. In terms of film work, but I generally think the designs of all the monsters are great. I think the kids are great. The acting is great. The directing is great. The score is great. The soundtrack is great. for me, the biggest thing is that, like, yes, there's some muddied logic. It does sometimes make the movie feel like the pacing is getting a little reined back, but I to me, it's still a small thing. I think everything else is firing on all cylinders, and I am typically a stickler about scripts, and that often can make or break a movie for me. But because so much of this movie works, the stuff that doesn't feels a little more negligible for me. So I'm still giving this a 9 out of 10.
Okay. I'm a little down on it as well from my personal enjoyment. I mean, this is an excellent first outing for a director. Obviously he had a pretty large team to help him.
Yeah.
From producers to, he had, you know, other people that actually wrote the script, even though this was his original idea. Maybe he needed a few more people, you know, giving notes or something along those lines.
Yeah, like it's just things. Some constructive, like cooperative, like engagement. Like I feel like that can sometimes help a movie. Well,
he talks about in some interviews how much of a, you know, storyteller he is with visual art, and how the story is told over multiple pieces, and that's very much like a film, you know, just going scene to scene. And I think the script is pretty good for what it is. I agree with you. It does get a little muddied in parts. I think there's just one or two elements that are definitely too far afield for Western audiences to really understand. Like the cult stuff with the mom is probably a little confusing. Like I had to look up elements of it to be like, okay, I can see why that was put in here. But yeah, for me, the CGI, when it works, especially on Opal, the kaiju at the end, it's amazing. There's some
it is oval.
That's oval. Right. There are some elements of the monster, I think, just design wise all the friends look great. There's elements of them flying around that look so fake because they don't feel like they have weight to them.
Because it feels like a cartoon.
They're flying around. Yes. And he talked about how he had the idea for this movie years before, but when he went into pre-production to like look at what animation was like, and you know, I don't know, 2006 or something like that, whenever he was looking at 3D animation, it just wasn't there. And so when he came back to it in 2012 or 2013, when they started production on this, it had changed so much. He was confident that they could move forward with it. And while I think the CGI is very good, like I said, there's a few things that do date this pretty horribly. And for the most part, I feel like in a good way, because like I said, it feels like kind of PS2 era music. And some of these look like PS2 cutscenes in parts, these little monsters.
Yeah, like that. It's certainly a style that charmed the pants off of me. Like I do agree with you. And I even with Oval, while I can defend his design, because I kind of like the ideas behind it, it's not my favorite, just like knee jerk reaction looking at a creature. I think it could have been a little more visually interesting. I do like it.
Yeah. I like how he interacts with the world. You know, one thing we didn't talk about is Luxor is the only one that's not CGI. He's like a dog fur suit.
Yeah.
Giant. What was the name of the Looney Tune creature? I have to look it up.
You're talking about?
Yes. Gossamer from the Looney Tunes. It reminded me a lot of him. It's like he stands out because he's so different looking from the rest. He's like, you know, 7 feet tall or 6 feet tall or something. And
the DVD or the Blu-ray has like on the inserts has two different friends, and it has a booklet that has the other friends all up around them.
I imagine there's some cool art in there.
Yeah, but yeah, Gossamer, I love Gossamer. giant furry tooth with sneakers is that thing even works is incredible to me.
Oh, and what's the Muppet that's Sweetums? Reminds me a lot of Sweetums. Yeah, too.
I can see Sweetums.
Who's just like is one of the few Muppets that is like fully human arm kind of articulated creature. I mean, I guess Big Bird is, you know, a person in a suit too, but I feel like Sweetums kind of felt the same way. Yeah, so I'm giving a 7 out of 10 for technical. For its importance as a kaiju movie, I was going to be a little harsher, but I actually do think, as far as like independent, you know, 21st century kaiju movies go, this one's actually one of the better ones, you know, when we're talking about the likes of, you know, things like Reiga and Big Man Japan. I really, really enjoyed this one. And it is a very cool kaiju sequence as well, of, you know, him destroying the buildings, people running away, them having to fight it, and then it having a weak point. And then this destruction sequence where it basically turns into like a black hole and sucks up all the friends.
Yeah.
Felt very, very kaiju-esque. Like I said, this entire movie just feels like a bunch of amazing Japanese genres smashed together. So I was going to go for a 6. I think I'm going to land on a 7 out of 10 for its importance, which, you know, is evocative kind of on our scale. It's evocative of the genre. I don't think it like adds a ton to it, but it is definitely, you know, bringing it to the forefront. What about you, Miles?
Yeah, so I'm still weighting this a little higher. As a tangentially kaiju film or a kaiju adjacent film, you know, I weigh it a little bit differently because, you know, it's not a kaiju film, but does it take things from the kaiju genre and enriches what it's trying to do with it? And I think this movie absolutely does. Like there is the kaiju sequences are purposeful. They are made with the knowledge that, you know, they're made with love from a kaiju perspective. And then I think inserting it in this Pokemon movie is such a cool idea. Like, this is a movie that maybe has been woefully underseen and certainly woefully underrated. Like the fact that it sits at the scores it does on Rotten Tomatoes is absolutely, I don't have the words. I just think it's so stupid. And it's insane. It makes me so mad. This movie is incredible. So, you know, obviously it doesn't have a lot of cultural or, you know, pop cultural history involved, but I could see that changing. You know, having a wide release that is easily available in the West is great. Getting more eyeballs on it by listening to podcasts like ours that talk about it so that you check it out. I actually double pay for this movie because I rented it from YouTube for like $2 and then loved it so much. As soon as I like ended the Jellyfish Eyes 2 trailer at the end of the sequence, I immediately bought this on Blu-ray. And I loved it. So I struggle to give a low score here because I think everything it seeks out to do, it does extremely well. And as something that is related to kaiju, I think it takes the correct things. Does it add to the kaiju genre as a whole? It's tough to argue that it does as a kaiju film, but as a kaiju adjacent film, I think it does because it showcases what makes this genre important and utilizes it in the sequences that it does very well. So I'm doing this as a little treat for me and giving it a 9 out of 10 here too.
Oh my, Miles. Oh my. Oh, that's going to put me at a 7.3, Miles at a 9.6. Is that right? No, 9 point, which means our podcast final is an 8.3 out of 10. Which, you know, right there in the middle, like I said, for my personal enjoyment, I was at an 8 as well. Miles, you'll be happy to know that just this year, they announced that there are collectible cards, Takashi Murakami Mononoke Kyoto collecting trading cards that have
the friends.
Well, I think a lot of his art, but friends on them as well. So they're like, besides the news of potentially the sequel coming, there are other ways to support the the creation of the movie. Well, I really hope the movie gets made because, like I said, that sequel trailer did feel much more kaiju. Like
if the it kids looks can so cool,
control giant kaiju monsters, that will take this movie in a whole nother direction. It does, like it's, like I said, seem like they filmed a whole bunch in 2011 or whenever they did the filming for this. So it'd be hilarious if we saw the same actors like a decade or so later. These kid actors.
Yeah, I hope most of the kid stuff has already been shot because, yeah, these kids are now like, you know, in college.
Well, yeah, I was about to say you have the opportunity to do something really cool and potentially do like a post-credit sequence where they're adults in some kind of
or at least I have a time skip or something.
Yeah,
but I mean,
maybe giving the friends to their children, you know.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I did think this was gonna get a slightly higher score, but I'm still happy that's a high score. But yeah, yes. I absolutely love this movie. I think everyone should check this one out. Make your own choice. I mean, certainly someone at Criterion was charmed enough to give this a really fancy pants release, and I'm grateful for it. I guess they lose my yearly letters about getting surf ninjas in there, but c'est la vie.
Well, this is the, you know, you gave it a 9 out of 10. This is the first film that has gotten a 9, I think, from either of us. Or did you give Wrath of the Titans a 9 out of 10?
Wrath of the Titans, I gave...
I didn't write it down right
here. No, it got like a solid 8. I gave it an 8, 8, and a 7, I think.
So, I mean, the highest rated from you for sure so far this season. I think the only other film that has gotten a full endorsement of 8 out of 10 was Monsters, the first movie of the year. But yeah, we both very much enjoyed it. I think this is one that is worth the rental from Amazon. If you don't want to get the DVD, check it out for yourself. You know, watch some trailers and dig into Jellyfish Eyes. We have some other weirder, you know, Japanese style independent films that I've added to the list this season and even next season that I'm excited to get to in the same vein, stuff that I've never heard of, but because of, you know, companies like SRS Cinema and other folks willing to, you know, roll the dice on international distribution of these films, we are getting just more, I would say, in general from Japan. So pretty great time to make a kaiju podcast.
Yeah, I think Vinegar Syndrome just put out a 4K Blu-ray for Reptilicus.
Oh my, wow. Need to check that out.
Yeah, I'll send you the link.
So yeah, that's going to do it for us here. 8 out of 10 for Jellyfish Eyes. You can chat us up via email by emailing kaijuversushistory@gmail. Talk to us on social media platforms at kaijuversushistory, or go onto our website, kaijuversushistory.com, to check out all of our prior episodes. There's now 166 other episodes you can enjoy. Find us on the Cosmic Crit Discord if you want to chat, or our Letterboxd accounts, Kaiju versus History on Letterboxd, to see our past reviews and 5-star format and see what we're watching in the future. Check out the Kaiju watch list. Thank you, Miles. What are we doing next week?
All right. Well, thank you, Patrick. And thank you, listeners. We're going to catch you next week when we are back for another Mockbuster Asylum film. Oh, boy. And one that couldn't have picked a more on-the-nose title. But will it have the guts to rip off more than the movie's name? Find out along with us next time for History versus Atlantic Rim.